I'm Julie Smith. I'm the director of the Transatlantic Security Program at the Center for New American Security, and this is the Brussels Sprouts podcast. I'm here with my co-pilot, Jim Townsend, who's now a senior fellow, adjunct senior fellow, after having served as the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense of Europe and NATO at the Pentagon for the last 8 years. And we're very pleased to welcome Corey Shockey, who I believe is our first American guest on Brussels Sprouts.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Welcome, Corey. She is many things, a great friend and a terrific transatlantic expert all around. But officially, we will say there's breaking news. She's now a contributing editor at The Atlantic. Congratulations on that. And she teaches thinking about war at Stanford and is also a fellow at Hoover, among other things. So welcome, Corey.
It is such a joy to be with you two friends.
So glad to have you here. You have your own podcast, and so we can only look up to you. You are a regular contributor also to what is now Deep State Radio, which has a huge following, and I've had the honor of being on once. Hopefully it won't be the last time. And you were also with the ER podcast for a long time and have a huge collection of followers, so we can only aspire to that, Jim.
And, you know, I did the ER podcast once just a few weeks ago, and I can tell you they all were missing you. They were, you know, we were there and they were like, where's Corey? And we said, well, we're kind of here. You know, we had Carl Bildt and we had NATO section and we had a lot of great folks on here. And we always start off with a question. And particularly for those like Carl Bildt who have been around a long time, this has been a good question. But I think it's really good for you too, because while you are all those things that was just said by Julie, all those things that you've been doing, I know that you also worked in the Joint Staff, and I know that you were there for a long while, because I was there too. And that experience, as well as everything that's followed, has given you a lot of you must have done a lot of thinking about lessons learned from those earliest days when you walked into the Joint Staff and you thought it was going to be this way, and over the years you've determined it's another way, that you must have learned a great truth along the way. What is the great truth that you've emerged with right now? As you sit there, what is that thing that you've come away with that is the great lesson learned for the past 20 years?
That math class isn't newly hard. Math class has always been hard. I am so struck at how much in our contemporary conversations, people think that there was a magic Elysian time where transatlantic relations worked flawlessly, where the United States was brave
really
and
true.
Virtuous, and Europeans were compliant and and did their
holding
fair share.
Yeah.
Exactly right.
Kumbaya.
And I'm a historian, and I can't find that time, right? What has always been the case is that the transatlantic relationship is a fundamentally good bargain for both sides, and that all of us get frustrated with each other. We always have to struggle to find common ground. Sometimes we paper over differences in ways that ought to be transparent to everyone, and I'm amazed we get away with it.
Yeah.
And yet, we and the Europeans care about the same things. We care about the relationship of a government to its people. We believe that relationship is indicative of the foreign policies countries pursue. And we fundamentally believe that people have rights and they loan them in limited ways to governments.
Yeah.
That's what links us together in such a durable way. It makes the relationship robust, but because it's so robust, people are always surprised when there's a problem, but there are always problems, and it always requires extraordinary public servants like the two of you, who in your time in government work hard to find common ground where Europeans can have what they need and we can have what we need, and those things overlap. And the kind of great work you're doing now to keep focus and attention on this essential relationship when the President of the United States does not appear to to value it nearly as much as he should and nearly as much as he will as soon as he needs something from our closest friends and allies.
Exactly. Yeah. Well said. And that brings me to my first question. I know we're both leaning in right now. We have 1,000 questions for Corey. We're like, can you stay all day?
Yeah, please, please.
So you write a lot. You've written books. You've written all sorts of long-form pieces, op-eds. One piece that you had recently about the NATO alliance had this terrific opener, which is, our European allies are our worst option except for everyone else. And you're getting at that. But in this age where not only the administration seems to have mixed views about where we're headed in the transatlantic relationship and appears conflicted, to say it lightly, our publics clearly on both sides of the Atlantic are shrugging their shoulders increasingly and saying, what good is all of this? And have lost sight of that history and the common values and the peaks and valleys. So how do we convey your tagline, European allies are the worst option except for everyone else? I mean, how do we talk about this with somebody in the south of France or in Bavaria or in the obscured corner of Norway or Kansas, for that matter? How should we be talking about the transatlantic relationship? How do we convey that point to an increasingly skeptical audience, really on both sides of the Atlantic?
I think that's such an important question, Julie. I am not convinced that that is a hard sell to Americans. It seems to me extraordinarily reckless on the part of political leaders to be indulging that recklessness. Because in my talks with my dad's Rotary Club and my mom's afternoon salon in my hometown of Sonoma, California, what I notice is that people don't understand why Europeans don't care enough to spend 2% of GDP on defense, or they have a generalized belief that Europeans aren't doing enough. And I share that. I know you guys
share
that.
Yeah, we do too.
Yeah, right, absolutely.
Right.
But that is, in and of itself, not an answer to anything, right? That's a question. The answer is, how are we most likely to get Europeans to do more for our common interests? The president seems to be taking the path that publicly demeaning our allies makes them likelier to spend more money for their own defense. And that much may actually be true. But what he forgets is that they don't necessarily have to make choices about their defense that are advantageous to us.
Right.
Right? Right? So if, for example, Germany should conclude the United States is no longer a reliable ally, and Germany needs to take a different path, and that path were to be a stronger, more independent European Union military force that can operate independently of the United States, that, depending on how they do it, could well be enormously destructive to our ability to fight alongside Germany and to achieve our common goals. So what the president's not wrong to raise the question. The president's wrong to do it in a way that alienates our friends.
Yep.
Most Americans get nervous when the United States has to act unilaterally in the world.
Mm-hmm.
They know we have to do it sometimes,
but
they feel a lot more comfortable doing whatever we need to do in the world if we do it with others.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
And the others we do it with, because they're the most willing and they're the most capable, are our European allies. Again, that's an easy sell for me at Rotary Clubs.
Right.
The way I sometimes phrase it is to ask the question of, who would be better?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I'll trade them in for anybody.
Right, right.
Yeah.
I'll gladly sell away the allegiance if you can give me something better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's not, you can't
make the list.
And there's
nobody better.
Yeah, no, there's nobody better.
And, you know, that was kind of one of the lessons learned coming out of the Gulf, coming out of the first Iraq war, if you will. When we went in there right after 9/11, we thought that there was going to be weapons of mass destruction, et cetera. We went in and there was a lot of allies who didn't like what was happening. They didn't support us. They weren't going to be part of it. And that began to roll into the thinking of the American people, because I was getting questions at the time. Why are we in there with just a handful of allies? Where's everybody else? What are we doing wrong so that they're not joining with us? So they kind of looked on it, not just that they were being disloyal because they weren't with us. It was, what's going on? Usually everyone is with us. We must be doing something wrong. And I found that to be very interesting.
Yeah, so I would just point out that you're actually talking about the 2003 Gulf War.
Yeah.
Because I'm a huge fan of the 1991 Gulf War,
right.
Where we had everybody in the region.
Yeah. I know.
And Jim Baker was so good at his job that we turned a profit on the undertaking.
Yeah.
I was, as Jim knows, the chief help in the Joint Staff Strategy and Policy Division at the time, and I had the great privilege of working on alliance management for that.
And I was doing that as well.
The difference between 1991 and 2003 was, in 1991, we wanted everybody's help. We made policy compromises in order to gain their allegiance to our plan, not least agreeing that we were only going to push Iraq out of Kuwait. We weren't going to prosecute the war collapse of the government.
That's right.
And we gave allies meaningful jobs they could do successfully, and we celebrated their success.
Yeah.
And we need to get back into the habit of being a good ally ourselves. And we are not being a good ally for the most part now.
Yeah. In fact, my boss, Daryl Johnson, who you probably remember from those days, he used to say to me, Jim, it's very hard to be an ally of the United States.
Yeah.
I would go up to him and go, I can't believe we're doing this. And he was saying, it's hard to be our ally. And it's really, really true.
I wanted to throw out something else in the area of European defense. We tend to focus on, at least on this side of the Atlantic, for all the obvious reasons, on the NATO piece of the puzzle. But the whole EU side is back in the headlines. This is cyclical. I remember in the back end of the Clinton administration, there's a lot of talk about EU moving forward with common foreign and defense policy and the Chocolate Summit and all of that. And Washington at the time had a very negative reaction to that, very worried about how it would divide the alliance, what it meant for duplication via the 3Ds and all of that. But now we find ourselves in a position where the UK is leaving the European Union, and the Franco-German election, depending on how the election goes in Germany this fall, could be started up again. There seems to be some intent or ambition laid out already that Europe is going to kind of again look at these multi-speed models and try to advance its agenda on the foreign and defense policy. And already they're starting to take some interesting decisions on defense, which could, I hope, after a lot of time talking about it, lead to some real capacity. But as somebody who's witnessed the ups and downs of this and the American reaction, which has been high and low, and we're very schizophrenic in our attitude. So we want you to lead Europe, but not quite like that. How do you look at it, Corey? What are your views as the European Union starts its engines? Let's say it does, and the Franco-German engine really takes off, and we see some developments. Do you look at that as a good thing? Are you worried? How do you?
I am a fan of Europeans through the European Union doing much more. My entire professional life, we have been having this conversation.
Yep.
And I think my own trajectory actually mirrors the general public attitude about this, which is initially when Europeans started talking about it in the early 1990s, I was deeply skeptical they were going to be able to do anything. I was resentful that I had to spend 6 months negotiating a NATO communique about whether the alliance was an essential pillar of European security or the essential pillar of European security.
I remember that very well.
Oh my God.
And it seemed like allies wanted a lot of credit in the present for things they were projecting they may someday do.
Yep.
And at a time where that actually had pernicious effects on in a changing security landscape, it had pernicious effects on the sense of cohesion of the NATO alliance as Russia ended the Cold War. I am now at a point where I am so worried about a weak Europe that I will so gladly take the problems of a strong Europe that, you know, we Europeans underestimate how much heft they actually bring in security policy. And it's a cultural issue. They're hesitant to threaten the use of force. They're hesitant to act on the use of force. And we actually need them being much more assertive in the world. And if doing it through the European Union helps them to do that, I will enthusiastically deal with the problems of how we mesh the whole thing together.
Yeah, absolutely right. Absolutely right. You know, I keep wondering if there was a West Coast vibe when it comes to these issues versus an East Coast vibe. So when you go back and forth and you come here and we talk about the EU, we talk about NATO, we talk about the West and the shared values and this type of thing, and it's something we're all passionate about, at least here in this room. When you go back to Stanford and to Hoover and you talk to students and a lot of your California colleagues on the West Coast, Is it different there? I mean, obviously, it's facing Asia, it's facing the Pacific. There's those kinds of issues that probably have a lot of prominence. But are we in a bubble here? And I mean, we are in a bubble, but that's for sure.
Can I just answer that? Yeah.
Yes. But I'm wondering, in terms of the expert community, are we also in a bubble there too? So that when you go back, it's a different kind of vibe. It's a different priority list. It's a different feel for what are concerns there when it comes to the U.S. role in the world and dealing with allies.
It's a really interesting question, Jim. I don't notice a geographic difference in priorities, but I do notice a couple of important differences that I do think affect the policy landscape. The first is that, living and working in Silicon Valley, there really is much more tolerance for failure. And
that's interesting.
That
that's
makes
really
people
good.
A lot more innovative. It makes them a lot more experimental. I was having a conversation with a Washington policy person out at Stanford a couple of months ago, and I rolled out this theory to him, and he said, "Well, the American government can't afford to fail because what we do is more important than making trivial apps."
That's a bubble.
and that's wrong in two ways. First of all, most Americans think the American government is failing.
Right?
Yeah. Right? So perceptually, you are mistaken. But second of all, this notion that technology is somehow toys instead of... We are in the midst of a revolution that is changing people's lives in profound ways. It's changing the American economy in profound ways, where whole professions are going to be swept away. And the political leadership of both parties is failing to address that in ways that give people a vision of what this new future looks like, where people can see a hopeful future. Right?
Yeah.
Like, we talk about it as though it's dystopian. In fact, most people's lives are immeasurably better because of this technological revolution. But just as with the Industrial Revolution, professions go away, but new ecosystems grow up around them, new kinds of jobs. In fact, jobs that are better, easier, pay more, more pleasant, more intellectually stimulating. But we're in the midst of this revolution, and not just the United States, but Europe too.
Yeah.
As advanced economies, as educated societies, as technologically innovative societies, we and the Europeans actually have the same set of problems, and it's perking into our politics, though in different ways.
Yeah, completely. All right, I'm bringing us back.
Sorry. Oh, I was going to take us over. Okay, then we'll
recess is over.
You're going over to Asia. No, I have to ask
back
you.
Back to math class.
Back to math class, kids. The president is going to, it's just a week or so away, the president's going to have his first engagement with President Putin. And everyone's waiting with bated breath to see what comes out of this visit. I mean, what are your expectations, and how would you advise this team going into this meeting? I mean, in many ways, the president's kind of boxed in, and because of Congress now has a kind of bipartisan consensus on we should be tough on Russia. What are they going to do? How do you see this meeting unfolding? Let's assume there is a meeting. Maybe you think there won't be one. And what would you advise them? How would they take this on, given the realities that they're facing?
So I hope you are right that the president is boxed in, and I hope you are right that consensus is bipartisan, because I am worried about it. I think the president and the people politically closest to him are fundamentally unsound on Russia policy. Their unwillingness to acknowledge the unanimous conclusion of the intelligence agencies that Russia is a threat to us, that it hacked our election with the intent of changing a political outcome. That's not a partisan issue in this country. That's a fundamental national security vulnerability we need to fix. And that the president and his closest political allies are unwilling to even acknowledge that makes me very nervous about the president's interaction with Putin. The second thing that makes me really nervous about the president's potential summit with President Putin is that President Trump has a weird, slightly lurid attraction to authoritarians.
That's right.
Right, that he makes apologies for the Chinese government about Tiananmen Square. Yeah. He makes apologies for Putin. Like, he's admiring strong men, by which he means leaders who do not permit themselves to be constrained by law or public attitude in their own countries. So both of those I find profoundly uncomfortable. The third thing I find profoundly uncomfortable is looking at these polls of Republican attitudes in the last several months, the extent to which my political party, which has an admirable tradition of being anti-authoritarian and anti-Soviet, and Vladimir Putin is behaving much more like a Soviet leader than like a Russian leader. The extent to which attitudes in my own conservative political party are amenable to being apologists for Putin's Russia strikes me as the third thing that's very dangerous.
I think that's a good point.
So I am relieved that the Congress passed the enhanced Russia sanctions. I am relieved that the Congress passed the NATO Article 5 affirmation. I very much hope the House of Representatives will follow the Senate's lead on the Russia sanctions bill, because I think the hopeful perspective to take on American foreign policy in the Trump administration is that as messy and acrimonious as our domestic political debates are, we are in fact modeling the strength and resilience of checks and balances in the American political system, both the institutions of our government and the resilience and power of our civil society.
All right, well, you can zip back.
Okay, we're going to jump on the plane that Dulles and fly you back to California just for a second. I found what you said about Silicon Valley and the view about the future is absolutely my thinking, too. And I think you're right in terms of that difference in this bubble that we're in, where we just in this East Coast and in Washington, we just can't get that. So, you know, so much of what think tanks do and what policymakers do, whether it's within the government and governmental processes or on the outside, it's still this brick and mortar 19th century approach. I mean, I think Ulysses Grant would recognize a lot of things if he were to come back. So if we could somehow meld in the responsibilities and the issues and the things that we think about and try to tackle here, with this new world that you described, not just technology, but the way people think there, that helped us develop this technology. If you were to meld that, what would it look like? I mean, not necessarily in terms of processes. We'd all have iPhones instead of Blackberries and all that kind of thing. But I mean, just in ways of thinking that we could get out of the 19th century and become closer to the 21st. What would it look like? What would you focus on?
So, my very favorite Onion article of all time was the headline that all of the potential presidential candidates for 2035 have already disqualified themselves on social media. It's funny, but it also points in the direction of the serious issue that you raise, which is a lot of the way new technology is changing American society is to make us more tolerant of mistakes and more resilient in recovering from them. And our government actually isn't that way. If you look at the way the government overreacts, for example, to incidents of terrorism versus other kinds of public threats. We diminish our own native resilience by being so brittle about those things.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that new technologies are making us are making possible is this notion that, it didn't work. I'm going to dust myself off. I'm going to do it a different way. And I do think that lots of the big tech companies, Apple, Facebook, Microsoft, you know, the broad-shouldered titans of the new economy, their innovation is outpacing legislation. It's outpacing regulation. And they're not accountable at the moment in a way that the social consequences of the decisions that they are making for their business are fully accounting for.
Yeah.
So what I think is going to likely happen is that those big companies are going to have to find ways, for example, to deal with the cyber problem. They're going to outpace our government on that, and they're going to model the solutions that we then can bring into public policy space, which is a super long driveway to the house of saying that I actually think American business and American civil society are likelier to be able to be agile enough to solve a lot of these problems, and then we can perk it. Once it's been road tested by businesses that have business consequences, we can pull those solutions into governance. But I don't think the model of government coming up with wise policy that it then enforces on businesses actually suits this new environment.
That's brilliant. Absolutely.
Well, unfortunately, I think we're out of time. I wish we had 2 days. We'll just have to get you on the next visit.
My friends, thank you so much for having me on. It has been a privilege. And as a listener of the podcast, it feels great. Thank you.
Well, thanks
for
joining
us.
And come back. Come back and congrats again on the new appointment at The Atlantic. We'll look forward to seeing your name in print more often, we hope. So take care.
Yeah, thank you.